If you're one of the people that love this show, make sure you go over to holyfoolproductions.com and check out our home. You can read articles. You can see my personal journals straight out of the typewriter. You can see the weekly link roundup of all the interesting things I run across. You can see drawings. You can see books recommended for the book club. Or if you're like me and you like things simple, you can just have it sent right to your inbox by signing up for the newsletter, which goes out almost every day. And of course, you can help support this show through either monthly subscriptions or generous one-time donations. All at holyfoolproductions.com.
Okay, I guess we'll just, for everybody listening, Drew and I were just having a conversation right before this, and we had some microphone issues, and he was just telling me a story, and now I'm going to have to make you tell that story again.
We were talking about M. Night Shyamalan, if that's how you even pronounce it. I don't even know. I kind of just get to the end of that word, and everything just falls apart, you know? I never really even look at the end of that word. It's just so long, I just... But no, I was telling Chad that we were talking about twists for whatever reason. And I was speaking on this story because I have this art studio down at Local Color, which is like a nonprofit. It's a nonprofit. They like repurpose empty buildings in San Jose and turn them into like incubators for the creative community. At least that's their mission statement. But so I have a space down there. And one day I got down to my studio and I'm painting like this large scale painting down there, and there's like a hole in it in the middle of it, and I was like, holy shit, what happened, like, did somebody vandalize this, did something fall in the studio, maybe it was like an accident? And then he's like telling me about it, so I was like super confused. So I put the word out and we tried to do some investigating, and when we reviewed the footage, because we have a bunch of cameras in there, it turns out that I had put the hole in my painting on one drunken night. I had thrown something, and you could see it on the footage, me throwing this thing, and it goes right through the canvas. But I guess I just didn't realize it that night. So it was like a fucking M. Night Shyamalan movie, you know? I was just like, in the end, I was the one that did it.
When I was like a freshman in college, I had this, as most people do in their freshman year of college, complete blackout night.
Yeah.
I think it was the first time in my life I'd ever experienced anything like that.
Where nice.
You first there were people blackout. Aware of me doing things that I was completely...
Right.
Had no
idea yeah, that's at all. Frightening. That's so frightening.
And I always wondered, I'm like, who's in control?
Right.
If I'm not home, who's in control?
Yeah, that's kind of scary, man. When people, even people that like sleep, you know, sleepwalk or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
It's frightening. Like
somnambulists.
Oh, is that what it's called? Is that medieval for sleepwalking?
it's the most difficult word to say when you could just sleepwalker. I think somebody just wanted a word that sounded like son of a bitch.
That reminds me of a story too. You know, let's make this story night. We might as well. Stories are what we want to hear anyways, right? But Gavin, who's one of my longtime friends who sings in a band I play in called Dredge, for anybody out there who doesn't know that. But he was living in San Francisco a while back, and his neighbor woke him up one morning, like pounding on the door. He's like, Gavin, you all right? And Gavin's like, yeah, what are you talking about? He's like, dude, your car. He's like, what? And I guess where they lived, it was like they had like an underneath garage with a door that opened up, and it went like down a ramp, and that's where all the cars parked. And the neighbor said he was pulling out in the morning to go to work, and the door swung open, and here comes Gavin's car, still running, nobody in it, you know, like barreling down the driveway, and like slams into the wall. And it was like, what? There was like nobody in it. It was just like resting against the garage door. So when the garage door opened, it came shooting forward, you know? And he's like, what is your car doing? Gavin's like, I have no idea. I don't know what you're talking about. And apparently, like, I guess like Gavin, you know, drove around San Francisco, you know, one night. Just came home and I don't know, for whatever reason, didn't open the garage door and just left his car running, you know, like, up against the garage. He has no recollection of that. And that is frightening. You know? Like,
that's terrifying.
If somebody could do that, like, what? And he doesn't even remember it.
Yeah, there's stories of people committing murder in their sleep.
Right. Yeah. I've heard some of those stories.
And it always sounds like BS until you actually hear stories of people doing stuff like that, where you're like, oh, I guess right. That is possible.
Right.
I remember, do you remember Unsolved Mysteries from when we were younger?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So that was on, or probably still is, on Amazon Prime. So, of course, I went through all of it. And there's one in there about people that, like, got up and they were, I can't remember what the term they used for it, but they were sleepwalkers, but they weren't walkers. They get up and run.
Oh, sleeprunners?
Yeah, so one woman got out of bed and bolted into a wall and broke her nose.
That's crazy, dude.
And then some other guy, like, died. Like, he somehow got out of the house and was running on the freeway and got run over.
That's some past lives shit, you know? What is that?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at these things, you're like, okay, that's not the way the brain's supposed to work. So there's got to be something like that going on, right?
Right.
Speaking of Gavin, I was watching Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
And have you watched that?
Yeah, I love Rick and Morty.
Okay, so there's the episode where they go off into space, and which happens a lot. I think it's like the fourth or fifth episode. And it's when they're in the virtual reality on the alien ship. They're trying to get some kind of magic fuel from Rick. Anyways, the dad like thinks he makes this awesome sale for an ad, mm-hmm. which is just hungry for apples, ? Mm-hmm. And they play this song, like this saxophone like riff. And I'm like, what is that? I know that song. So me being me, I had to look it up. And it's this song called Baker Street by Gary Rafferty.
What the hell?
So I'm listening to this song and I've heard the saxophone riff before, which I would play for you right now, but we would probably get knocked for copyright. And you would recognize it. It was popular in like 80s movies. But then the verse kicked in and I had to do a double take because it sounded exactly like Gavin.
The singing.
Yeah.
Oh, weird.
His voice, even a melody that he would sing, yeah. It blew my mind.
Weird.
I started the song over like three times and I'm like, whoa.
I'll have to check that out. So you're saying it was just like a beautiful angelic voice that just calmed you? And yeah. I'm just kidding.
Speaking of Gavin, if the internet world is correct, you guys are working on more stuff?
Yeah, we have been. We've been writing a lot, like in the last 6 months. We probably get together once a week, twice a week if we can. We got about like maybe 10 new songs.
When was the last album? What year was that?
2000. Oh my gosh. Maybe it was 11. I think it was 11. I think it was. I can't even remember that last record. 2011, I think. Yes, it's been 7 years since we...
You guys toured since then, but you haven't written anything together.
We did a couple like anniversary tours or just some random markets since then, but haven't written any new music in 7 years. But it's been great. Like, you know, it feels really good. We're all at a... You know, it was a nice little break, I guess you could say, even though we were playing, you know, here and there. It was just nice to kind of focus on ourselves for a while. And, you know, there's a sense that we've matured a little bit, you know, so that's nice coming back into it and kind of just revisiting all of our past relationships and old ways. But it's been great. We just get in the room and just start jamming. I mean, it's like, you know, we all four speak a different language. In that sense, we speak our own language, and when we get in that room, we just start talking musically, you know, and it feels good. It's just kind of like an alcoholic, like that first sip, you just go right back to where you are, you know.
That's the only time anybody's used that as a positive analogy ever.
But it really is. It's cool, and it feels great because there's no pressure, there's no outside pressures of any sort. And you know, I think this has been a good build. It's been a build up for a while. So now we're finally getting to do it. And it massages the soul a little bit, you know, and it's just all this stuff that's been festering in us over the years that we're finally getting to get it out. It feels great. And we're doing it kind of like how we used to do when we were kids, where we're not having all the tricks laid out around us, you know, and that means like, you know, when I have keyboards or all these little other instruments at the moment, in this part of the writing process, we're just, you know, trying to be as raw as we can. And that's just us playing our instruments and kind of taking back to those old school rock roots, you know?
When you go back, when you've been apart for a while and you go back to making music for with a group of people that you've made music with before, like you said, you fall back into it. But at the same time, do you find the same bumps, or are those type of things, like, do they dissipate with time?
It feels pretty familiar. I think like those bumps are still there. And those, I think, for us, at least, a lot of those bumps come when we're starting to try to organize it or really structure it out. You know, that's when we come across these bumps, because I think we all have a different idea of maybe where the song could go or what it could be, you know. But those are conversations that need to be had, you know. You need to, and that's the whole, I mean, that's what is being a, that's what collective is. That's what being a band is. It's the merging of all the ideas, you know. So you have to have a conversation at one point on, and you have to come to like an agreement. And that's the beauty of it all. That's like where the magic lies, you know. It's like, so it's great. And those are the bumps so that we have. It's when it comes to the structuring or the arrangement or things like that. I think we all, it's pretty easy to agree on a part that we like, because we sit there and we play it, and you can just tell, you know, it's coming from within that we enjoy that particular piece that we're playing at that moment. Or, you know, I think we're all on the same page in that sense, where when we hear something, we all can agree that we like it and we should work on that, you know, because that's what we do. We get in the room, we just jam, we record it all, and then we go back and listen to it, and Dino edits it all down into like a more of a focused little piece, and then emails it to us, and we just review that and we talk about where we could go or what could work here and stuff like that.
And what's that conversation like? Is it always democratic, or does it ever get contentious?
Yeah, I mean, it's been all over the place over the years. And we've been a band for 20 years. We've had these conversations, over, you know, thousands of these conversations. And sometimes they could get really heated. But for the most part, I think, I think we're all pretty, we all get along. We're all pretty mature in that sense. And we could, you know, we could just move forward if it's very democratic, you know. Definitely if there's a majority that we're moving forward with that, you know.
And what wins in the end, you know, like, I say, I'll just make up a scenario. Say Mark's wanting to go heavier with a part, mm-hmm. and maybe Gavin wants to go lighter, mm-hmm. and it's the same part, mm-hmm. and they both sound good.
Right. Oh, you
know, yeah. Work through that.
No, that's great. We turn it into two different parts, and we're like, you know, we're going to go heavy here, and then we'll take that other section we like, and we'll put that somewhere else, whether that's before or after, I think. Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's how songs get built a lot, too. You know, you just, it's the dynamics, and it's, as you jam through it, it's the dynamics of the ups and the downs, the changes. You're still playing in the same key. You're still, moving around in the same world, but it's those dynamics that kind of define the different sections.
I could definitely see that philosophy of using both in Leitmotif. Because it definitely feels like you went so many places with it.
Right. Yeah, we did, man. I think like we were just, you know, we were so young and we were just trying to throw out every idea that we could. And also, you know, it was a reflection of what we were listening to at the time. So we were trying to include all those cool things, sounds that we liked into our own music. So it just turned into this like amalgamation of a bunch of different stuff. And that kind of defined our sound over the years. So I think, you know, we're in a fortunate position where we can, I think, kind of put out anything and people will just accept it, whether it sounds like, you know, Middle Eastern laundry music or Southeast Asian war dances, or, you know, something.
Have you ever got like some backlash between, I don't know, say if someone were to compare Leitmotif, which for anybody listening who hasn't heard it, it's more, you correct me if I'm describing this in an incorrect way, but it is more expansive and more almost soundtrack / Pink Floyd, in the sense that it's not strictured to what we would define as a normal song, you know, first, chorus, verse.
Right.
It goes in movements.
Sure.
And then you compare that to something like the last album, which was probably the closest thing to pop that you've ever done.
Right, right.
What do you hear from people on those, you know, like, oh man, we always say it when we're younger, like, oh, the first album was the best album.
Right.
Do you ever hear that kind of stuff?
Oh yeah. All the time. I mean, everybody says that about everything, you know, the book's better, The book's better. The first album was better. My first girlfriend, I won't finish that sentence. You know, I think like we're always nostalgic of the past, but if you're trying to break that down, I don't know I think it's, you know, especially when you talk about like in the first record, it's that initial impact that probably has, you know, changes you the most. So that's why you're constantly trying to revisit it. But
right. That's why the Sex Pistols are considered such a great band. They only made one album.
Right. There you go.
There's nothing they did to compare it to.
Yeah.
I mean, when I think you make a good point there that people don't really realize is the reason we have such a fondness usually for first albums is because we go into it not knowing anything.
Yeah.
We have no expectation at all. This is a band we've never heard before.
And that's interesting, right? I mean, that part is so magical. Like it's the mystery of it, right? The getting to know, it's like getting to know a new relationship and it's going to alter you. And that's why you're so impacted by it, because it's going to alter you more than, you know, the second record where you're already familiar with it. It's such a metaphor for life or getting to know somebody or, you know, have a relationship with another human being. But I don't know. I think like it's interesting too, for speaking on our career, that like it's been, you know, we've put out a handful of material, and it's almost like it's going, feels like it's going full circle, you know, as kind of it should, I think. And we're very fortunate in that sense to be able to look back on your whole career and like, I don't know, just see where the ebbs and the flows of it, the billabongs of it, if you will.
You ever feel like people pay too much attention to, you know, like the one song, the one album, instead of like, hey, you know, like this is, like you just said, this is a cycle. This is something so much bigger.
Yeah.
And that they don't notice the journey. You ever feel that?
I don't know. Maybe not so much. I think like there's a, you know, from what I understand from all our fan responses, there's a variety of people that kind of like all the different aspects of it, you know. I don't think it really heavy weighs on any one particular album for us.
What about as a visual artist? Do you ever feel that people get stuck in one type of thing that you did?
I don't know. That's a good question, man. Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't get too much dialogue back on my art. You know, I don't get enough criticism back. I think it's, you know, people get the art and they got it because maybe they liked it or and so that conversation doesn't have to be had. But I don't think I get, you know, I get to talk. It's easier to talk about the music for some reason. I think it's, you know, because it involves other people and because they're like specific timelines or something. But with my art, like I don't get a lot, as much feedback, you know, so it's hard to answer that question.
You think that's important, maybe? You know, I mean, we live in an era where people get feedback instantly on everything they do,
right? Like online, sure. I think it comes from my peers nowadays more than anything. You know, like my surrounding artists, that like people like Ben Henderson or something, that you know, we work on art together and next to each other all the time. So those criticism comes from that, but it's mostly uplifting, I think. Like, but that's who I want to surround myself with, anyways. Like the uplifting community. You know, I don't want, but you know, I guess there's something to be said about those days of art school where, you know, you would hang up your piece and have the whole class critique it and just spit and piss all over you.
It kind of reminds me of what they do at, supposedly according to the book Creativity Inc., what they do at Pixar is they, when they premiere an idea, they're just allowed to ruthlessly rip it apart.
Yeah, that's important for Pixar shit.
It's terrifying to them.
It's terrifying.
Oh my God.
It's very terrifying.
There's, because we have this democratization of ideas, which in many ways is very healthy, at least as far as the world being able to see what was going on Twitter in, you know, Egypt during the revolts and stuff like that. Very important. But at the same time, you know, look at what's happened to stand-up comedians. It's important for stand-up comedians to like get up and bomb. Just so that they can learn what jokes work and what jokes don't work. But now, because of that same democratization, it's on YouTube within like an hour. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is detrimental to us? You know, that maybe we have too much access to everyone at too many times?
Yeah, I think in the overall picture, for sure. I don't know what the results are, but you can also choose to ignore that stuff, right? But I think if you are that comedian, then I don't know. I guess it's so hard to not look at the world as it is now. You know, it's like that's just the reality that we're living in. That and some career paths, like, you know, see it differently. You know, like I think especially comedy in general. Like, you know, you go to the shows and they have you put your phones in these like locked nets, you know, so you don't film the material and put it up. I understand that, because like a joke is so I don't know, it's like gold, I guess, for it's like
the intellectual most, property, right?
Yeah, and it's so yeah, I don't know.
Do you feel like at any time have you ever felt the pressure from something like we'll say Instagram likes to steer the direction that you're going with art?
Not for me. No, I don't think so. I mean, of course, maybe you'll look at a post and you'll see that you got more likes on one than the other, but I think a lot of times that's just random or for whatever reason, I don't really pay attention to that stuff. And it definitely doesn't guide my art. You know, I'm at a point where I just, you know, I feel like I'm always behind. I'm always cranking out stuff. So I'm just, you know, that's my focus on just what the next piece is, what the next idea is. And that's what I get excited about. So that's what drives me. I'm not, I'm just, you know, it's just from direct source to the page. I'm not really so much altered by anything outside of that at this point.
What does steer your directions? You know, like, are you walking around just like writing little things down? Like, that would be pretty funny. I'm going to try that out. Or,
definitely,
in your head.
Yeah, definitely in my mind, for sure, all the time, man. Looking for inspiration, everything. It's like I'm addicted to it, you know. But yeah, I'm just, you know, just being creative is problem solving. You know, it's just changing the perspective on something, and that's what I'm obsessed with. So it's just ideas all day long, you know, all day long.
You've gone through, I'll use the word movements again. You know, like there's certain periods to the work that you're doing, at least from my perspective. You know, like right now you're doing a lot of the sports cards that you're repainting.
Oh, right.
And stuff like that. How do you know when a period is done?
That's great.
You're like, all right,
right,
I'm over this.
Yeah, I think like I'm kind of stuck in my overall general theme, you know, whatever that is, my trans psychedelia. Like whatever my psychedelic artwork, that'll always be like a steady stream for me. But you know, now more than often, I'm doing like these side conceptual projects that I really enjoy doing. So those are like my markers and into my next movements or whatever. Like I just did this life-size orange sauce for Iguanas, which is a Mexican food place in San Jose, and you know, down at Local Color, like the place where I have an art studio. We have this project called Project Our Town, where we're bringing elements of San Jose and building them out inside Local Color. So we have Winchester Mystery Bar. We have a Japantown train that like sits behind the stage. We have this giant shark mouth, wooden shark mouth being built. And then me and two of my friends, Carlos and Shay, Carlos Agrio and Shay Nyquist built this life-size orange sauce for iguanas where you can step inside of it. It's like a photo op. And if you guys aren't familiar with orange sauce, anybody who's listening, it's San Jose is kind of, you know, known for it. It's just a special fruity kind. It's not a hot sauce, but it's not really creamy. I don't know. It's kind of a...
It's chorizo grease.
Well, it's not. It's vegan, though. you know, it was certified vegan. So I don't know.
Really?
Maybe they were using that before and now they're not. But, you know, a lot of the different Mexican food restaurants around here have their own style of their orange sauce.
And my friend Tim Wong from, he lives in Hong Kong now, but he lived here before. And I just saw him last week and he came back with his wife for the first time, I think, in 8 years or 9 years, we couldn't remember exactly. And when we were leaving, hanging out, he's like, I'm going to take her to Lovick because she has to taste the orange sauce.
Yes, yeah, that's great. Yeah. It's so true though, man. Everybody's got to taste that sweet orange sauce. But so yeah, we're doing that project, Our Town in local color. So that's been really fun. And then within that, I have my own space, which I'm building out this sports. Chad, you mentioned that sports thing. So I'm building out it's kind of like it's a museum that celebrates the athletes who did or do drugs, you know, the professional sports athletes. So there's kind of like odes to different players, and it's not really fuck sports, but it's, you know, it's a profanotype. You know what that, like a Grolixes? You know what a Grolixes is?
No.
It's like those cartoon swear words, you know? It's like typographical. Oh,
yeah. I didn't know there was a word for that.
Yeah, they're called like Grolixes or something. They're typographical symbols that stand for profanities, you know? Like symbol swearing.
Yeah, but, exclamation point, question mark, at
exactly,
symbol.
Exactly. So the store is called, you know, That Sports. And it's just kind of like, it's like an FU to sports. It's just kind of a... But it's also like a mock shoe store. So it's kind of like if you're walking a Foot Locker or something. So I have this shoe wall and I have all these like different pictures up that celebrate different athletes who have done drugs or messed with drugs over the years.
That brings me back to, you know, you described or sort of described your art as psychedelia, because I know like the label isn't necessarily exactly how you would describe it, but maybe that's how other people do. So the question is, how much do you think actual psychedelics have influenced your art?
Oh, I mean, an extreme amount. I mean, from taking them just to studying the culture of it, you know, that's like that is like been a huge inspiration for me. From, you know, anything from like surrealism to, you know, whatever this like new age, modern, like Alex Gray kind of stuff, you know, right? Like just a huge inspiration.
Do you feel that beyond art has had benefit for you as well?
Yeah, I think so. I think it definitely, you know, opened up some doors, you know, some perceptual doors for me, for sure. When I was experimenting, when I was a child, you know, or not a child, but a young adult, it opened my mind up to a lot of things. I think it's got me more analytical, maybe, and more liberal.
And a lot of the, you know, like DMT and to some degree people who take mushrooms talk about the idea of seeing the connectedness of everything. Is that something you've ever experienced?
Yeah. I think, you know, while on it or even just with the communications that I see on a day-to-day basis, I think like we're all connected in that sense. You know, I think we all have this interconnectedness that just travels through us that we are not as aware as we should be about, you know? And I think like when you do psychedelics, the visual pathways present themselves, but you have to understand that like those visual pathways are also mimic like the energy pathways that travel through the universe. So even though they can't be seen while we're not on psychedelics, they're there and they're connecting us all a lot more than we think that they are, you know?
And how do you, like, from a mental standpoint, you know, like that we get caught in the minutia of every day and we forget those things, like you said. From a mental standpoint, how do you keep connected to that memory, to that knowledge?
I guess it's just staying connected with culture and just being involved in, you know, what's being produced. I think you definitely have to like seek out new design, new adventure, new inspiration. You know, you can't, I don't think you can stay as connected if you were to just pull yourself off the map and go away for a while. But, you know, with this technology, it's inevitable. And beyond that, I think it's just paying attention to, you know, your peers and whatever inspires you. Just, it's kind of hard not to find new things nowadays to be inspired by.
Do you think any of that has manifested itself in your music?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, same thing with music, you know, just like art, you see a visual you're inspired by, you try to translate that into your own layout. It's the same with music. You know, I think you'll hear something or just even, you know, something as simple as just a simple violin in a part of another song, and that'll inspire you to want to do that to your piece or to want to make a piece like that, you know.
So then you probably agree with me and with Austin Kleon that's to a certain degree, maybe not necessarily theft, but copying is essential.
Definitely. I mean, it's hard. I mean, there's so much creativity out there. There's so much. I mean, especially when it comes to music, there's only freaking 12 notes, you know, give me a break here. So it's like arrange those in some kind of way. I mean, it's all coming from, you know, whatever, the Beatles or old composers or whatever. It's just regurgitated. But yeah, you know, you add more elements and it's like making a salad. It's just like you add that, you know, it's the same salad as your neighbor, but you just maybe had some pumpkin seeds in there and then voila, that's your little spice.
For me, I've always had this theory that the Beatles ended up sounding like the Beatles because they failed, that they had limitations. You know, if you read any of the stuff that the guys have said, the living ones and the dead ones who wrote it down, about the early days, all they really wanted to do was sound like Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis. And there isn't a single thing that they released that sounded like any of that. So I can't help but feel like the Beatles sound came out of the inability to completely copy something correctly, like Led Zeppelin too, right?
Yeah, I guess they had to choose a different path at some point. I think we all know that if you directly mimic something, you're not going to be innovative. You're not going to get the credit you deserve. I mean, you have to put your own little twist on it, and so. They understood that they were just four white dudes from England, you know, so they had to at least maybe try to sound a little bit more white or something.
Well, there's a great story too. And of course, you know, as with music legends, I think we talked about this with another guest. You never know what's true. You never know what pops up to be real or if it's just, you know, something we keep telling over and over again. But supposedly the sound of reggae came from the attempt to sound like Motown and American soul music, but they just had worse equipment and worse
and like two,
recording
two
equipment
fingers.
And they were behind the beat because they weren't very good
because they were stoned. They were so fucking high. Are you kidding me?
And they just stumbled on that. I don't care if that's true or not. I love that story.
I believe it. I mean, it had to happen in some way at some point, right? I mean, there was a beginning at some point, and that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, I think you can hear the bridge in ska too. You know, we're like ska is like just a little bit closer to Motown.
Yeah.
Or there's the, can't remember what the name of the album is, but there's the first album of Bob Marley and the Wailers. And it doesn't sound like everything they did afterwards. It sounds way more like Motown.
Right.
I feel like that failure of is almost like a gift. Like, oh, you want to sound like that? Guess what? You don't get to sound like that.
Sure, sure.
The true difference between an artist and someone who gives up is the artist realizes that, oh, this is what I sound like. This is what I paint like. Mm-hmm. This is what I write like. And they accept it. And then they swim in right. themselves.
Yeah, that's stage two or three or whatever. I mean, you know, you first have to learn from your masters, from your peers, you know, and then you glide on this path for a while where you're just kind of, you know, just kind of copying that and perfect, you know, perfecting it. And then the next stage is I think experimenting. And then the stage after that is looking back and realizing what within that body of work is yours, speaks the most true to you. And then whatever little quirk that is or gimmick, if you will, then you run with that. And that's when you develop your own style.
You actually remember going through parts of that process, or is it kind of a blur?
Yeah, I can look back and see where I took chances or whatever, and something worked out. And then I just ran with it because I liked how it was, you know, and then I kept producing more stuff that was similar to that, you know.
In stage one, who were you copying?
Probably in the beginning, you know, of course, all my peers, but I think I was for me, I started like copying a lot of like album artwork. So I would just, you know, duplicate my favorite records or something. And so that was just an amalgamation of a bunch of different artists. But then I think I started, you know, getting more into comics and stuff. So I would draw more like a comic style. And then through high school, I was probably trying to be, you know, like Van Gogh or or something like that.
Let's see. One of the things I love about doing these episodes with people I actually know is stuff that I never would have found out comes out.
Yeah.
I had no idea that you got into comics.
Oh, right. I mean, more for the art, really. I mean, I think like, and it was like some like bizarre comics too. It was like, oh, what was it, one Ralph something? Or like the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers. Shit like that, yeah.
Well, what about with music? What were you copying when you were starting out there?
Probably just, you know, that the 90s classics like Nirvana, Red Hot Chili Peppers. And then I was like really into punk rock. So I loved like NoFX and Bad Religion and Fugazi. So there was a lot of that in the beginning. Tool, you know, I love Tool. So I loved a lot of that.
Who was your bass guy? Like, who was the guy that you're like, okay, that's the bass player I want to be?
I mean, it's always been Flea, but even though I'm not even a hundredth of what that guy
is. Nobody is, guy, right?
That guy's nose.
He's just got some kind of mad.
His nose hair could slap a bass better than I can.
I can see the Tool for sure, too.
Yeah, definitely. I think, yeah, with the whole band, I think there's little elements of that for sure.
Well, I feel like, from the way that we've been talking and from what I know in the past about what you guys do as Dredge, it reminds me a lot of what I hear about how Tool puts stuff together. You know, the way the pieces fit together, like, oh, let's put this first. Mm. Let's move this here. There's more of an, I don't know, there's a kinship there that I can see.
Mm, definitely. Yeah, I think we learned a lot from them in this, I mean, within the mystery of it all, you know, I think that was the main point, is just stay focused on the art. All the other bullshit is important. Just try to make a timeless piece of art in a way that you're pleased with, you know, like be true to yourself. So
in doing the season, like, as you know, before, like interviews weren't the main focus of the show, of any of the shows I've done before. So I've been like listening to and watching a bunch of, you know, like famous interviewers, like just trying to understand their style, exactly what we're talking about, you know, like what can I learn from that person and take from that person and, you know, make my own sauce. So one of the things I've been watching is Larry King has a show.
This is America. No, just kidding.
No, it's called Larry King Now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the Larry King that I remember was, I can't remember what the name of the show. Well, I think it was just called Larry King Live.
Larry King Live, yeah.
Was him at that news desk, and,
right?
You know, it was very official,
right?
And this is more casual. Like, and some of the episodes are filmed in his home, some are in hotel rooms. One of the most recent ones I watched, I've been going back to the beginning, so it's like an early one, is with Matthew McConaughey, right after he had done what the heck is the space movie called?
Oh, Interstellar. No.
Yeah, Interstellar. Thank you. I guess he keeps like a log. I don't know if this is like what he does every day of his life, or just if this is just when he's on set, but he kind of takes a log of the day, like a journal of what's going through his head during the day. And then in the future, after he watches his performances, he'll mark down any time that he can tell that he's acting. Obviously he's always acting, but he says, you never want people to be able to tell you're acting. And anytime he sees that, he pulls out that log and looks at that day. He goes, what was I thinking that day? And I just thought that was a completely fascinating way to take this idea of self-criticism and make it into something productive that can inspire some sort of growth.
Right.
Do you ever find yourself listening to any of the songs that you've recorded or looking at some of the older pieces you've done and seeing things and going, I can fix that in the future, I can do that different later?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, definitely, listening back on the old records, you always see parts where you could have been more busy or more steady or even performed it better. But I tend not to focus on that. I don't know. I think it's important to just put it out and move forward, you know?
Is that freeing?
Like, you know, like being able to go, it's done.
Yeah, it is. And I think like, I've been accustomed to that over the years because I produce so many paintings. I'm able to do that. Just like get it done, move forward. Don't look back. Like, I think, I don't know. There's something to be said about that, you know? I mean, I'm sure every artist overanalyzes their work, you know, their old work or anything, but I mean, and that could be advantageous as well. I think you can get something from that if you want to do that. But for me, I think, you know, my mindset, my theme has always been just get it done, move forward, on to the next one.
When you look at a lot of the problems that artists have where they stall out,
yeah,
you know, like it seems like from my perspective, you're always moving forward. You're always doing something. Do you think that's what causes people to stall out, is that they get too stuck on what has already happened?
Oh, definitely, man. You have to ignore those doubts and you have to face your fears. You know, you got to take risks. I mean, that is what being creative is, you know? Yeah, I mean, and it's great because that translates to all other aspects of your life too, you know? I think, you know, especially when you're creating something, you don't have to show that to anybody in the end, you know, but just like, just set a goal, produce it and accomplish it, you know, like finish it. I think the act of finishing something is very important, you know, because then you can reflect and then you can move on and, you know, and then you can eventually look back and learn from it, you know. But if you never finish anything, then you're just swimming upside down.
Does that weigh on you ever? You ever have something that's just sitting there?
Yeah, there's been projects over the years that just like kind of chill out and I'll take long breaks on them or something, or maybe I'll work on it with somebody and we don't get to finish it. And I think about, you know, I think about those projects all the time, but still, it's trying to move forward.
How many things do you think you're working on at a time usually?
Man, I've been so overwhelmed lately. You know, I got like a list of just people have ordered stuff, you know, online or just, you know, for whatever reason. So I'm constantly working through that. You know, I was working on that orange sauce for a while, for a couple of weeks. And then the project still at Local Color, the Our Town project, we work, you know, we try to work on that every Sunday and then every other chance we get. And then I got, you know, working on the music as well. So it's overwhelming at times, man. And it keeps me up at night and my mind is rarely quiet, but I wouldn't have it any other goddamn way, Chad.
Well, when you say that people are ordering stuff online, do you mean that like people are ordering commissions or what?
Yeah. So I'll do, you know, I do these mystery paintings online, or I just have like order, you know, paint by order kind of stuff on my website that people can purchase and then I'll paint it for them. Like, you know, recreations of stuff I've done or
whatever. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. What's that like to go through and like do something that you've already done? But like, are you taking, like we had talked about, are you taking some of that? I could have done this part better with you.
Yeah. And that's where I could see it too. Cause I've done a couple where I'll do, you know, like three at a time or something. So I'm able to like look at them all side by side and be like, that's interesting what I did there. Why didn't I do that here? Or that looks better. So I'm going to do it here. So it's very transformative. It's like, it's been a fun process. I mean, it's not something I do much of, but there's a couple pieces that I have on my site that people can order and then I'll paint.
That'd be a fascinating series.
Yeah.
To see the same piece done like a couple of years apart.
Yeah, right.
Like four or five times. Who was it? I can't remember who. One of the impressionists painted a cathedral, or not, I think it was charcoal actually. Did charcoal of a cathedral throughout the day as the light changed on it. Mm. It was the exact same cathedral.
Oh, that's cool. So he kept just altering it with the light.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
That's patience too.
Yeah.
I don't have that patience.
Well, you can. Someday maybe. It's in us all somewhere.
When you're doing commissions, you know, like, so obviously a lot of the stuff that you're doing is from your own mind 100%. You know, like you have the idea from impetus all the way to completion. But when you're doing something for someone else, there's a step in there that at least where the other person has input. How is that different?
It's totally different. I've done some commissioned pieces or some mural work for some, you know, startups around the Silicon Valley. And that's fun. I enjoy that process as well. I relate it to working with the band where you get all in into a room and you just conceptualize, you know, and you hone it into an idea that you all like, and then you move forward and you keep honing it away until everybody's, you know, for the most part, content with it. And that's like being in the band. I have a lot of experience with that kind of stuff. So I enjoy that process as well, you know.
See, that's something like when doing the podcast and everything, like it's all me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when I look at, you know, bringing people in to help, or, you know, like one day having an editor to be able to do some of that stuff so that I can focus on doing this more, I feel this weird fear.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, how am I ever going to explain that? What do you think that I need to know? You know, like how do you relinquish that control?
Right. I think you just have to see the process through, right? And then you can decide if you like it or not. Maybe you don't. Maybe you do need that to have all that control. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Like, I think to run your own ship and have it well greased and run smooth and be content with it and have enough energy to do that, that's fucking awesome as well, you know? I think it's situational. If it comes to the point where that's what you need to do in order to stay more focused, and, you know, that's the process you got to go through. And I'm sure you'll whittle away at it until you're comfortable with how it is.
Do you think that you're an introvert or an extrovert?
Man, I would say more of an introvert, but the older I get, the more extroverted I am. You know, I think I've evolved socially over the years, as I think we all do. I think you pick up on these quirks and ways to, you know, assimilate in the public and speak to other human beings, you know. But I think I can be both. I think I definitely go back and forth. I'll be introverted for as long as I need to be, and then I'll explode and go bounce around for a while, you know.
I think having to do interviews for the band and as an artist has developed some of that extrovert skill.
Yeah, definitely. A lot. Yeah. That and just a lot of situations I've been in over the years, whether it's like, you know, different jobs or, you know, whatever. So a lot of traveling, you have to really learn how to acclimate, you know. So that's been educational. Towards the end of our last couple of records, I tried to stay away from a lot of the interviews. I used to let Mark and Gavin do them because they're really good talkers. So
I'm definitely an introvert through and through.
Yeah.
You know, I'm friendly and I like people, right. But I just, you know, I get exhausted by social interactions.
Right.
But I think it's hilarious that the hobby, or if you want to call it the art that I've chosen, is me talking to people.
Right. Well, you're a little hidden, you know.
Right.
So we're not face to face, which is a different form of communication. I guess it's a little bit easier, right?
Is it easier for the person on the other end to be in person or on the phone like this?
I don't know. I'm enjoying this right now. If I was looking at you, I might be turned on or something. So that would be. But I hear you. Hell is other people, you know. And sometimes, Jesus, man, so many fucking weirdos out there. It's like, you know.
Well, my thought too with doing things in person, not only because there's more, I should say, different technical complications involved in that, you know, like a microphone bleed and all of those fun things,
right?
But I also feel like, especially if I'm talking to someone I know, there's more tendency for it to veer into the personal, nobody listening is interested in that type of conversation, and less into the, hey, we're talking about these things.
Right.
Yeah. Like, you find yourself talking to someone you know, and you're talking about other people you know.
Oh, right.
And just using the first names, and everybody listening is going, who are they talking
about?
Right,
right, yeah.
Lam and I went through that phase when we first started podcasting, and before we realized that wasn't that wasn't awesome for the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, let's use the names like Donald or Oprah. Yeah,
right. Like what we were talking about before we actually started the recording, when we're talking about getting people comfortable, I feel like being remote makes that process for at least people I don't know a little more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So you having done as many interviews as you have, what have you learned on, you know, the people that were good at making you feel comfortable that you didn't know? What were they good at? How'd they do it?
Right.
Was it charm?
Yeah, charm. Oh, totally. Charm, personality. Man, just give me a joke. Give me some random joke. Like, break the ice right away. You know, could give me some of your personality right away so I can judge you or meet you in the middle somewhere or something. But I think, like, you know, for me, it was always ask me, you know, let's talk about something that we don't normally talk about, or, you know, let's not talk about these same subjects that that are generic and easily Wikipediable. Is that a word? Wikipediable?
It is now.
You know what I mean? So, like, we don't even have to talk about anything relative to us. We could go on a tangent, but let's have a bizarre conversation, I guess, or something different from what we're used to. That's what I would enjoy, you know?
Yeah, that's what I've always wondered. You know, I haven't been interviewed myself very many times, so I have very little experience. But I think about even people like somebody that's Matthew McConaughey. We'll use him again. Someone who's just released a movie and they go on those press junkets.
Yeah.
And they're interviewed by like 20, 30 people in one day.
Right.
And when you hear stories of people going through that, it's always that it's mind numbing. And I think it's because of what you're saying is they're literally answering the same questions over and over. Like when you guys would do press stuff as the band, how many times did you have to answer the question about how you all met?
Right. Exactly. Too many.
I've been trying to do it. It's terrible. Probably a bad idea, but I tried to do as little prep as possible for every episode, which is always interesting when I go in with someone I haven't met because I have no knowledge of them at all.
Right.
But I feel like that's the easiest way to avoid doing that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Just kind of trying to feel it out. But like you said, it could go astray too, right? Or,
Yeah. And I think that's fair. You know, like I'm as nervous as the guest is.
Mm.
It could go wrong at any moment. It's okay because, you know, it's not live. I was just doing the intro for the first episode today. And I was talking about that idea of the first words that come out. You know, like when you're podcasting, when you're doing the solo part, you have no idea where to start.
Right. Totally.
You know, like what's the first word I'm going to say?
Right.
You know, because people are just turning this on. Say, hi, hello.
I kind of like that start. That should, you should include that in ours where you're like saying hello for like 5 minutes. Like,
I feel like that would be,
people, you know, would turn it off.
If I ever had like a, you know, like a premium behind the scenes package that I made from somebody,
right,
it would just be all the intros of the stuff that happens before the podcast.
Like the bloopers, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, sorry. I didn't know the camera was on and you're not wearing a shirt. Or, you know, the 50, like with you and I today, 50, hello, hello, hello. Oh, my microphone's not on. Okay.
Classic.
What book do you think I need to read next?
Let's see. What about something that really hit me? Trying to link the chat in my brain to my experience with something that was really meaningful. It's like, I want to give you something meaningful. You know, all the stuff I've been reading lately is like about like murder and stuff. Oh, you know what? I mean, I don't know. This was really inspiring to me. I've read this a lot over the years. It's just those, I might have mentioned this before, but the letters from Vincent van Gogh to him and his brother.
Oh, with Theo?
Yeah, just that, all that stuff is so touching to me. I don't know, man, something about it. Have you read any of that stuff?
I haven't.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's great because it doesn't really necessarily have to go in order, you know, really. It's just like you can pick up, it's like reading poetry in a sense. You can just pick up here and there, and just like the passion within, you know, within that guy, it just always melts my heart. And
there's there's a couple collections of Kafka's writings, his letters to people as well, and they're just fantastic too. I feel like we've lost that, the beauty of the letter.
I know, right? Seriously, like they're gonna release like a book on like Hillary's emails or something. Like,
can't find those.
They'll never come out.
No, but they do have the tweets now. I guess that's the equivalent. Right. How sad is that?
I know, that's pretty sad, dude.
Not that I hate Twitter, but I mean,
right?
There's a beauty to those letters, the skill that most people don't have anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
Would you like to tell everyone? I'd be surprised if anybody listening doesn't know who you are already, but tell them who you are, what you do, and where they can find you.
Oh, right. Well, my name is Drew Roulette. I live in Campbell, California. I am a musician and a painter, visual artist, I guess. You can find me on the interwebs, drewroulette.com, or you could seek out my bands. I play in a band called Dredge and another band called Dark Heaven. So check it out.
I didn't know you moved to Campbell.
Yeah, I live in Campbell now.
That's great. Hang out more. You're closer.
I love it over here. I hit up the old farmer's market every Sunday, dude.
You know, one of the best ways to support a podcast is to go over to the podcast app that you're using, especially if it is Apple Podcasts, and take 5 minutes to sit down and rate and review the show. Just give it a star rating, give it a paragraph letting people know what value you get out of the show. Because that's how we communicate to the world what this show is about if they haven't listened to it before. And it's also how we communicate to guests or possible guests what the show that is inviting them on is about and what people think of it. So please take the time to rate and review us. Thanks.